You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Everyone these days could use a little support, and your friends at the ESO Network are no different. With the ESO Network Patreon, the cool thing is when you help support us, it's you who will benefit. With four tiers starting for as little as 25 cents a week, you can listen to some of your favorite network podcasts early, hear exclusive content, maybe get some ESO swag, or even possibly take a shot at the geek seat. All you need to do is sign up at patreon.com/ESO Network.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 241 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk the next Batman Second Son number 6, Superman Red and Blue number 3, Catwoman number 31, Justice League number 61, Nightwing number 80, The Flash number 770, Wonder Girl number 1, Batwoman season 2 episode 14, and Justice for All. Black Lightning season 4 episode 12, The Book of Resurrection chapter 1, Crossroads. Superman and Lois season 1 episode 6, Broken Trust. The Flash season 7 episode 10, Family Matters, Part 1. And DC Legends of Tomorrow, Season 6, Episode 3, The X Factor. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. All right, Cletus, first up for DC news. Tuesday, August 31st, DC will publish 5 48-page annuals. Batman Superman 2021 Annual Number 1. Green Lantern 2021 Annual Number 1. Harley Quinn 2021 Annual Number 1, Suicide Squad 2021 Annual Number 1, and Midnighter 2021 Annual Number 1. I have those 2021s in there, but I wonder if they're in the actual official titles or not. I'll be curious to see that when it actually comes out.
My guess is no, but I could be wrong.
So that's how they had it in the article, so that's how I put it in my notes. Did you see the article I had posted on our Facebook group about these annuals?
I don't think so.
Okay. The one I'm really interested in is the Green Lantern one, because the cover has Jessica Cruz wearing a Yellow Lantern costume.
Oh, you know what? I did see that. Specifically that picture. I'm pretty excited to see that one, because hers was one of the few Green Lantern stories that was actually decent in the future state. So I'm curious to see what they do with that one. And also, importantly, they're actually letting her be a lantern. Now, granted, it's a different color, but, you know, it is the reason I like that those characters. I'm glad that they're letting her actually do that.
Yeah, and with her being a yellow lantern, if she does become a yellow lantern, I'm thinking she's not going to want to do bad things. So it'll be interesting to see how she fits into that group. So I'm really excited about checking that one out. All right, moving on to our next bit of DC news. It's the main man against the Man of Steel in Superman vs. Lobo, a 3-issue black label oversized miniseries from writers Sarah Beatty and Tim Seeley, with artists Mariko Andolfo and Arif Prianto.
Interesting pairing. Be curious to check it out. I'm not sold on it, but it's an odd pairing for sure.
Yeah. The fact that it's black labeled has me intrigued that, you know, they can do stuff outside of continuity on it that might be interesting. So it's worth checking it out just because it's black label.
Well, I have very much enjoyed the black label stuff over most of the mainline comics for a while now. So I agree with you. That definitely gives me hope that it'll be worth checking out. It's the point. The quality of the black label stuff has been so consistently better. I wish they would take some notes, is all I'm saying.
Coming up in our next bit of DC news, the Suicide Squad's next mission is to hunt down the new Swamp Thing in a two-part crossover event this August. The event takes place August 3rd in Suicide Squad number 6 and the Swamp Thing number 6. Not really sure about that one.
I mean, theoretically, it's an interesting idea, but I do worry that it's going to end up, it's intruding on whatever story they're telling in just the Swamp Thing title right now, because it, thus far, at least to me, has had absolutely nothing to do with the Suicide Squad. So, we'll see. It could end up being really good, could end up working out. It could also end up being something where DC tries to, like, synergize something, and it just makes it worse.
Yep, totally agree. All right, in our next bit of DC news, Dwayne Johnson has been cast in the Warner Brothers movie DC League of Super Pets, and will voice the role of Crypto the Superdog. The animated DC film centers on Superman's dog, who teams up with a flying cat to stop crime while the Man of Steel is on vacation, and is slated to release in theaters May 20th, 2022.
I was about to make a joke that I'm pretty sure that that movie was going to happen before Black Adam, and then your release date just confirmed it for me, so it's not even a joke, it's just reality.
I'm surprised they're releasing this in May with the start of the summer movies. Of course, you know, it may have a big draw for kids, so.
Yeah, you know they're hoping it's a summer movie for kids to check out.
Yeah, and, you know, hopefully things are back to normal by then.
I mean, I would hope so.
I would too, but you never know.
Yeah, that is definitely true.
All right, for our next bit of DC news, the CW gives DC's Naomi a series order, which I was kind of happy to see that. And not surprised, especially since Naomi is now part of the Justice League.
And it's exactly the kind of hero that CW wants to feature right now. I mean, it's a female hero, and she's a person of color. I mean, literally the exact hero that CW wants to use. And I think it's great. Like I said, I'm not surprised at all. I don't think there's a more obvious candidate for a CW show than her, to be honest with you. Teenage, female, person of color. I mean, it's literally everything they want.
Yeah, and I'm hoping it's good. So that's what I'm hoping, not like we've seen with some of these other CW shows lately.
Yeah, sure. I hope so too. I agree. I legitimately very much would like the show to be good. I would love it. I would love for this show to be great. I have absolutely no faith that it will be.
Of course you don't, because you're a pessimist.
I feel like it's pretty earned pessimism at this point with what CW's churning out right now.
I know. I can't argue with you on that too much, so. All right, in our next bit of DC news, Black Lightning spinoff series Painkiller was not picked up by the CW. And after seeing the backdoor pilot for it, I'm not that surprised.
I honestly was surprised by this. I was surprised because I thought it was to be clear, it was not, in my opinion, a backdoor pilot. It was legitimately just the pilot episode. I thought it was better than the Green Arrow and the Canaries, I thought was bad. I thought that was bad, and I was like, ooh, I don't know if this one's going to get made. I thought this episode was, his episode was decent. I mean, obviously they needed more time to be able to flesh, you know, their roster out more, but I am legitimately surprised that they're not continuing it on, just because it felt like half of Black Lightning's season was dedicated to setting up his show. They seemed so sure that they were continuing that on.
I have to agree with you. They did feel like it was a sure thing, and with it not moving forward, it does seem kind of weird. I guess the reason I wasn't surprised by it is during the Black Lightning season, he seemed overpowered to me, and I was wondering how that was going to be in his show, if he was going to be overpowered. But it was.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I highly doubt that that was a factor in the decision for the show, though. Sure, you know, it comes down to budget The fact that it doesn't film in Vancouver, I have to imagine that did factor in. I'm pretty sure they want to film all of them there.
I'm sure you're right about that. But Black Lightning didn't film in Vancouver either.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though. So, but it's ending, and that's an excuse for them to be like, let's not.
Yeah, that's true. All right, in other DC news, the CW chairman, Mark Pedowitz, reveals Season 8 of The Flash will open with 5 episodes featuring crossovers from various Arrowverse titles. So I think that's pretty cool. We're going to see some team-ups, whether they're, you know, main cast characters or secondary characters on the different Arrowverse shows. It'll be good just to have a mix-up, especially after what we've been seeing recently. Hopefully it brings a fresh breath of fresh air to The Flash.
I think it's an interesting idea, for sure. My concern, though, and again, this is certainly the pessimistic view, is that they really just don't have a good idea of what to do for The Flash. And so they're like, I don't know, throw a bunch of other dudes in. I'd like to be, again, this is something I'd like to be wrong about, and I know that that's a pessimistic viewpoint, but there's nothing in The Flash right now that suggests to me that that's not the case. I just don't think they know what they're doing. I think they're just kind of stumbling around, throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks.
I hope not. I hope they actually have a plan with what they're going to do.
Sure, I'm sure they have a plan. You know, I mean, like a loose idea of what they want to do with these crossovers, but is it a legitimate roadmap long term, or is it, do they have a loose plan for those 5 episodes? And then it's kind of like, where are we going to go after that? Maybe here? And then kind of, you know what I mean? Like, they're all like short term plans. It just feels like the show has no vision for where the show is going. You theoretically, they clearly want The Flash to be on forever, like Supernatural was. And I get CW's desire to do that. But if you're going to do that, I think it would behoove you to have a pretty well thought out roadmap for a couple seasons, I would think. Because otherwise you just get this meandering crap that we get where, I mean, I'm pretty sure we're getting an end to this, you know, the different forces storyline. But it feels like they're probably going to wrap it up. But where do you go with that in the future? It's so out to left field, but you can't also ignore that it happened. So like 2 seasons from now, how are they going to deal with the fact that they did this storyline? You know what I mean?
Yeah. You're right. I have to agree with you. It doesn't feel like they have a plan, but I'm hoping that I'm being optimistic. I'm hoping they have a plan, or they've come up with a long-term plan after this Forces story.
I would like that. To be clear, I would like that, but it's not like the showrunner has changed, and this showrunner, to me, has been on the show long enough to have demonstrated what the show looks like under his care, and it's terrible. It's the worst it's ever been, and he's still running it. So, I mean, I just don't see how we can expect it to change.
Yeah, I have no argument.
I know I do it a lot. I don't like being this thing. I want to like The Flash. I would very much like to be able to sit down every week and have a good time watching an enjoyable show. And it's just not. It's just not. And it's hard for me to be optimistic about it when it's been consistently bad for 2 seasons now.
All right, let's move on to our last bit of DC news. This fall, the Arrowverse shows will have a new lineup. Tuesday, 8 p.m., The Flash, Season 8. Of course, that hasn't changed. Wednesday, 8 p.m., we have DC Legends Tomorrow, Season 7. And then after that, we have at 9 p.m., Batwoman, Season 3. And that's all the Arrowverse shows we're going to have on this fall. Coming mid-season, we have Stargirl, Season 3. We have Superman and Lois, Season 2. And then Naomi. So when I looked at the schedule, I was like, wow, we've kind of cut down our CW shows. And they're actually splitting them. We're going to have 3 of them starting in the fall and 3 of them starting mid-season. So, and we know Stargirl was shorter its first season. I'm wondering if Naomi is going to be a shorter show or if it's going to have a longer season.
I do feel like we're getting towards the end of the era with these, with this CW stuff. I think once, whenever it is that the Flash ends, I do feel like the rest will follow shortly after that. I think you have to take into consideration Painkiller not getting picked up is really surprising to me, just because it wasn't terrible. Like I thought the Green Arrow and Canaries one was, it had, I thought, a lot better buzz behind it than the last one that didn't get picked up, but there's now been two, they had never not picked one of these up before. And now 2 years in a row, they've not picked up another superhero show. And I would argue they're getting diminishing returns. I don't know if the ratings necessarily reflect that. I know Flash is still their big winner, but I don't know, Drew. I'm not saying it's ending next year or anything like that, but I do feel like if you're looking at it as an arc, we're on the downward part of the arc of this era.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. And we could be seeing the slimming of the fat. So.
Well, it could certainly use it. If trimming down the number of these shows that you have, I don't know how, but in some way improves the quality of them, I am all for it because, yikes, right now, they need something. They need to do something to change up these shows because they're just stagnant. They're all really samey. I feel like I'm watching effectively the same show five times in a row. They need to do something.
Agreed. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
We are the Air Station One podcast, and we approve this message.
Hey, I'm Judy, and I've been a listener of Earth Station One for over 10 years. Yeah, every day while Mike edited together over 550 episodes, you know all that geek-themed blah, blah, blah. I've listened so much that now I hear howdy in my sleep. You too can enjoy all the Earth Station One fun wherever fine podcasts are found. Okay, Mike, I did this for you. Are we going to get another dog now?
The Earth Station One podcast, over 10 years for geeks by geeks.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk. The next Batman, Second Son, number 6. Batwing is in Ratcatcher's lair. He came for the cure for his sister Tam. Ratcatcher has an army of homeless children ready to attack Batwing on his command. Ratcatcher gives the command and the children attack. Batwing puts up a shield, and right when Batwing's shield gives out, the Gotham PD show up. Gotham PD is not here to help Batwing. Gotham PD opened fire. Batwing punches a column and the ceiling comes crashing down, giving the children time to get away. A cop gets the drop on Batwing, but he lowers his gun and says, "I wasn't here, and neither were you." We see that Luke returns to the hospital empty-handed. Tiffany, the little sister, she's not happy that Luke comes back without the cure for Tam. And we see her, she runs by Luke and then gives Jace a big old hug. I don't know about you, Cletus, but that ending there where she gives Jace the big old hug, it feels like, to me, it felt like the turning point. We're going to start seeing Jace on his journey to becoming the next Batman. That's what that felt like to me there.
Yeah, I would agree with you completely. The only other thing I wanted to say with this is I felt like, and I think this is part because of the comic, the nature of these digital comics, they're shorter, so they have less room to work with. But the Ratcatcher thing, I thought, left a couple, trimmed too much of the fat off, where it wasn't completely clear to me. I think Ratcatcher died. I'm pretty sure. But that wasn't made explicitly clear. And it also, I had kind of forgotten why Luke was there in the first place. I know that, I'm not saying that that's the comic's fault necessarily, but it didn't really communicate the urgency of why he was fighting Ratcatcher to me once he was actually there. And then he got away. Like, that whole incident finished up, and I was like, oh, okay. And then he went back to the hospital. I was like, oh, yeah. That didn't really come up at all, though.
So I was not confused by that at all. I knew what was going on. And maybe that's because I'm taking notes on it.
I will think that's me. No. I'll take the blame on that one for sure. I'm not – but I will say I did think Ratcatcher's fate I thought was a little bit vague. I'm pretty sure he – or I thought it was a she. Regardless, it doesn't matter. But Ratcatcher I thought died, and I thought that was a little unclear. And also just the whole thing felt really fast. I didn't totally get – the entire purpose. I know why he went to confront was to get the cure, but the whole thing just felt really rushed to me.
And once he got there, it felt like Ratcatcher didn't have a cure to me. And I didn't get the same thing you did. I didn't think Ratcatcher died. I just thought Ratcatcher got away. I could be wrong. I'd have to go back and actually look at it now because you made me second guess it.
We know for sure Ratcatcher got injured. We know that for sure. And one of the policemen says that makes a comment that it appears to be a serious injury and that they should maybe do something, to which, you know, the partner replies, I don't care, it's a mask. And then the only other thing we see after that is one of the kids coming back and picking up the broken mask, which to me implies that the original Ratcatcher is dead and that this orphan might be becoming the new Ratcatcher.
Oh, okay. Now that you recap that, I remember that now. But anyways, I have a feeling we're done with Ratcatcher for now. Anyways, I don't think he's going to be back in the story.
I don't see, if that's the case, then you don't show the kid picking up the mask. I don't think that we're done with that.
All right. I guess we'll wait. We'll have to wait and see what happens. All right. Moving on to our next title for this week. Superman, Red and Blue, number 3. Our first story was called Deadline, written by Jess J. Holland and art by Laura Braga. Clark is on a deadline and Perry is worried about getting the story on time. Bruce calls Clark and asks him if he's going to be late for dinner. Diana says she has $100 that says he can't make the deadline and dinner. Bruce says, make it $10,000 and you've got a bet. If Bruce wins, the money goes to a rural agricultural renewal. And if Diana wins, the money's going to go to journalism education. Now, Bruce and Diana continue to discuss why each other thinks that they are going to win the bet. And as the audience, we watch what Superman is doing as each makes their point. And of course, Clark does make the deadline and dinner. One of the things I liked about this story, Not only was it a fun story, I love the use of color in this story. Because we had light blue and light red backgrounds with Clark, Bruce, and Diana having darker reds and blues that made them kind of pop out in the panels. I really liked that a lot.
Yeah, I agree with you, Drew. And that's actually one of the reasons I've liked some of these stories more than some of the Batman Black and White. Not that I haven't enjoyed Batman Black and White, but if the stories are equal in terms of writing, generally I've preferred the Superman one a little bit more because I feel like the red and blue allows for a little bit more on the art side than black and white does. That's not to say that that's always the case, but I would say on average between the two titles, if everything else is equal between the stories, I've preferred what they've done with the red and blue.
Now, our second story was called Kilgore City, written and illustrated by Michael Fife. Superman and the Justice League take on Kilgore, Brainiac, the Manhunters, and Cyborg Superman. There was something that was a little off with this issue that didn't click with me. It felt like we were supposed to have a fun read, but it wasn't. I didn't really care for the dialogue. Superman's dialogue didn't feel like it was him to me. And also, I thought the artwork was just okay. But I think some of the coloring was off. Some of it felt like it was more colored, while other pages felt more black and white.
I agree with you, Drew. This one didn't really do it for me. It wasn't bad, but it was definitely one of the weaker ones in this comic for me. It was fine.
Next, we had A Man Most Saved by Brandon Thomas and art by Barat Pekamazika. Cat Grant is interviewing Dr. Charles Miles on WGBS. We learn that Superman has saved Dr. Miles so many times he's lost count, but he's had many wonderful conversations and even some partial lunches. This time, Dr. Miles tells the story of how he found Superman lying on the ground after being shot by a kryptonite bullet. Dr. Miles is able to remove the bullet while Superman continues to fight with his heat vision. One of the aliens that attacks Superman is disguised as one of the producers. He pulls out a gun and tries to shoot Mr. Miles. Superman flies in front of Dr. Miles, saving him. The gun is actually shooting red kryptonite. Acting quick, Dr. Miles stabs the alien in the hand and punches him, saving Superman for a third time. Me, I love both the story and the artwork on this one.
I agree. This was phenomenal on both counts. Writing was excellent. The art was really good. I very much enjoyed the art for this story. And it makes a difference. This is the thing. Like, if you put the art from the last story onto this one, it's not as good. It just isn't. It's just one, again, I know I care more about the art than you do sometimes, Drew, but these stories like this are sort of what prove my point for me.
I see where you're coming from. All right. Our next story was called Something to Hold On To, written by Nick Spencer, art by Christian Ward. Superman invites kids from a group home without families to visit the Fortress of Solitude. They get to fly with the Legionnaire rings, play with crypto, see future possibilities, play robot chess, eat Owen clouds that taste like cotton candy. But a Toyman attacks with robots, but Superman is able to stop him before he could get into his vault. I thought the story was fine, and I thought the artwork was pretty good on this one. I like the idea of kids coming to the Fortress of Solitude and just playing. But I thought the Toy Man attacking thing kind of fell flat.
I think that's a great way to describe it. I liked the kids visiting the fortress felt good. I liked that. The Toy Man attack didn't really land for me either. I also have to say that I thought this comic suffered more than it should have from a really poorly placed title. It put it on what was like the second to last page, but it was like before you flip the page. So it made it seem like that was the end. And then there was actually like, you know, either one or two more pages after that. It was very, very poorly placed. I don't know what they were thinking with that.
I have to agree with you with that because I thought that was weird myself.
You're not going to put it at the beginning. You put it at the end, but you definitely don't put it two thirds of the way through. That was bad. And it was one of the things I know that seems minor, but I really thought the story like hurt because of that more than it should have, because it really threw me. I thought the story was done and I was like, well, that didn't totally work as an ending, but okay. And then I turned the page and there was still, I think, one or two more pages. I was like, wait, what? And by then I was already kind of out of the story. It really threw me off.
All right. And our last story was called Little Star, written and illustrated by James Stokey. An asteroid is heading towards Earth, so Superman uses his heat vision to break it up. He finds out it's an alien creature. He grabs some ice from an asteroid belt and cools the creature. And he learns it's a baby, so he attaches LexCorp satellites to it so it can find its family. Kind of a cute story, but nothing that exciting.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Catwoman number 31. Selina goes to Mr. Roy's party. She talks with him, shakes his hand, which he has sprayed with citrus oil. Later on, Mr. Roy learns that his painting has been stolen. Selina slips into her Catwoman outfit and heads to Mr. Roy's safe. She easily gets the code to the safe from the citrus oil on the number keypad. Catwoman is able to free Poison Ivy and get her out of the house because the alley town strays took the place of the caterers. Mr. Roy shoots himself once he realizes he has failed. Apparently he was supposed to destroy Poison Ivy, and he was working for Simon Saint, the guy who's behind the magistrate. Simon Saint decides to focus his cleanup first on Alleytown, and he has a weapon called the White Witch. Wonder Woman gets another visit from the mysterious man in the trench coat, who warns Selina changes are coming where she and the strays might need to hide. Before Selina can ask him any more questions, he disappears Batman style. Selina talks with Pam, but Poison Ivy's mind is not quite right. Also, Pam tells Selina No poison, just ivy. And she repeats it several times. And I got to tell you, Cletus, that reminded me of the last episode of Swamp Thing we reviewed, because we had a Poison Ivy character in that who said there was no poison, just ivy.
I think that was the personality that was in charge, so to speak, there. So I agree with you completely. I think that's exactly who that was.
At the end of the issue, we see Leo has been captured by the crazy priest assassin, and he wants Leo to confess his sins.
I liked the return just reminding us again that the assassin is still out there, especially when they introduced what appears to be the real... It's interesting because the assassin feels like the main threat to Catwoman specifically, but it was interesting seeing the kind of the curtain come back here and be like, yeah, Simon Saint's behind this too. And we can see that whatever's going on in Catwoman is definitely supposed to be factoring into the Batman books as a whole.
Right, but it's clear that the crazy priest assassin is Catwoman's nemesis in this, not just Magistrate itself. That's, you can tell it's in the background going on, and it's going to affect Catwoman. But the real threat's the crazy priest assassin, who's been biding his time to make his move. When we see kind of his first move here is taking Leo.
I'm still so interested in what his goal is, because it feels like it's more than just killing Catwoman, because he could have done that a number of times. And so I'm hoping for a good payoff with that, because the other the other alternative, unfortunately, would be that it really was no reason for him not to kill her earlier, and the book just kind of let you down. So I'm hoping for the first option.
Me too. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Justice League number 61. When the issue opens up, Brutus has returned from Earth, and he's talking to a scientist lady named McMurph. Brutus tells her that the Earth is the world for them. Black Canary finds herself alone on Naomi's world. She's suddenly surrounded by indigenous people who seem none too friendly. They try to attack her, but Black Canary uses her sonic scream. Naomi stares at her hands. She can see them, but she can't feel them. She's suddenly surrounded by indigenous people, and Naomi disappears before their eyes. In her place is a batarang, and the indigenous people just stare at it while Batman tells her to be quiet, and they sneak away. Then it goes off like a bomb, scattering the people. Superman is having problems with his heat vision. Batman makes a suggestion, and Superman is able to open his eyes. Brutus is right in front of him, and Brutus punches Superman. Oliver wakes up and someone is playing with his bow. The dude electrocutes himself because Ollie has it set up to only work with his fingerprints. We see that Aquaman wakes up, but then he passes right back out. Hawkgirl hears Black Canary scream and finds her. And they kind of discuss the smell, being back together with Ollie, and then Brutus appears fighting Superman. Batman coordinates attack on Brutus, who's happy to take on the League, because if he wins, their world is his.
I'm very intrigued by the idea that Naomi's home planet supercharges all of the Earth heroes. It does make me wonder, though, does it also supercharge the natives of the planet, so to speak? So the villain that they've been fighting had previously lost to the Justice League, and then the comic clearly demonstrates that all of the Earth heroes are being powered up. So you have a powered up Superman and Black Adam, and they apparently lose. So I'm assuming the comic is telling us that any powered being gets supercharged on that planet.
Yeah. Well, we even saw Black Canary say her scream was more powerful than normal. The only exception I can see to this is Aquaman. We saw him wake up and then pass back out. I wonder if the powering up is having a negative effect on him.
That would be interesting. I wonder how Bendis would spin that.
I don't know. I was wondering. One of the things that crossed my mind is I was wondering if it had to do with him being away from water too long.
It's certainly possible. Drew, I think you're right. I'm just really curious, like, what Bendis's answer for why Aquaman would be negatively affected would be. I'm curious to see, because I think you're right.
And I think we'll see that play out in the next issue. All right, we also had a backup story in this, the Justice League Dark. The issue opens up in Las Vegas outside the Page by Page Books shop. Ragman is fighting Manicore's harpies, broxai, and werewolves. The Justice League Dark shows up. Xantana casts a spell to send the monsters back into the books. Elnora is found at the August Priory ruins. She's taken to a hospital where she heals at a miraculous rate. A voice in her head tells her it's time to leave, and Elnora realizes she's on a quest. John Constantine realizes that they need to talk to the man of the book. I don't know about you, but I'm really enjoying the Justice League Dark story in this. I mean, to me, it still feels like the quality it had when it was its own book, and I'm happy about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so good. Like I said, it deserves its own book, but if this is the compromise to keep this story going and us to keep getting Justice League Dark as a thing that's being published, I'll take it. I can accept that compromise.
Well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Nightwing number 80. And before we even get into it, I have to say, this was my favorite title of the week. And I'm very excited about Nightwing moving forward after reading this story. Dick gets woke by his dog barking and a police knocking at his door. He finds out that the homeless man, Martin Holt, who he bought a hotel room for last night, was murdered. The police are investigating him as a suspect in a string of murders of the homeless who've had their hearts cut out. Dick calls Barbara and has her come back to his apartment as an alibi. Barbara quickly lets the police know she has a law degree. Barbara lets the detectives know that because Dick has an alibi and the police have no direct evidence linking Dick to the crime, it would be embarrassingly incompetent to arrest him. Now, Dick goes in search for the son, Elliot, starting at the crime scene. Barbara decides to run a search of the hospitals, shelters, and the next of kin. We see that Nightwing calls in Tim Drake, Robin, for help. Tim Drake gives him a present from Batman, a wallet with a chain on it. I thought that was freaking hilarious. Tim goes undercover into the tent city of the homeless kids with Dick's new dog. He learns that Elliot feels safe there, but there are too many kids in there with the same story as Elliot. Brewtail and the Electrocutioner show up at the homeless camp for kids. The kids have been stealing to survive, and Blockbuster wants his cut. A fire breaks out in the camp, but it wasn't Blockbuster's people. But Robin does smell the accelerant, and Nightwing states it was Heartless. I love this issue. I loved it so much.
I can't think of why you would like it so much, Drew. Was there some like character you like that was in it or something?
Oh man, it was great seeing Tim Drake as Robin again, and him partnering up with Nightwing. I loved it. It felt like old times to me.
The minute he said Tim Drake, I was like, Drew's gonna love this issue. It could be garbage for the rest of the issue. Drew's gonna love it. To be clear, it wasn't. It was a very good issue, but I had to laugh as soon as I saw it. I was like, oh, found Drew's favorite comic this week.
You knew it as soon as you read it, didn't you?
Yep. I agree. This was really good. This is a very good comic right now, and it has been since the start of this run that they're doing.
The artwork was fabulous in it. I was like, you know, you thought you would be reading a Batman or Superman title with the style or with the quality of art that was in this. This is really good.
I agree. It matters. This is the thing. Like, I wish DC would appreciate this more and care more about. I know part of it is your hands are tied by the artists that you can get to work for you. But if you allow them time to work and you put the right artist and their style with the right kind of book, you can get great books. Like good art can carry a mediocre written book. And to be clear, it's not. This is both. This is both good writing and good art. So, I mean, this is just the best of both worlds.
It sure was. And I'm very excited about the next issue of Nightwing. It can't come soon enough. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, The Flash number 770. The issue opens up with Jay Garrick meeting Happy Terrell. They have a meeting with the president who asks them, how would you like to end the war? Thus, the Flash and the Ray meet. The Flash and the Ray's mission is to get the Spear of Destiny before Hitler does. They sneak into Kogsawa ruins to find Otto Frentz. better known as Parasvol, who has the ability to cancel out a superhero's powers. The Flash and Ray, they were captured and tortured for 5 weeks on board the German cruiser Cormorian. Speed lightning struck Jay Garrick, and Wally took over his body. Now, Hitler was given the Spear of Destiny. Wally and Happy disguise themselves as Nazis. Jay regains control and punches Hitler, and Happy gets the spear. Next, we see the Speed Force takes Wally inside Reverse Flash's body as the Reverse Flash is being admitted into membership with the Legion of Doom. And I did have to say, I liked the art style change with the Legion of Doom to be more cartoonish, because it felt more like the Super Friends to me.
Yeah, I agree. Also, in my opinion, it's just better artwork. So I'm hoping that that's the style that the next story is in. This is basically the opposite of what we were talking about with Nightwing, where, again, it's subjective, so not everybody's going to have this opinion, but I really don't care for the art style we got in this comic. And I don't think it was poorly written, but I really didn't enjoy it that much because I couldn't get into it with the art. And again, that's subjective. But for me, I couldn't get into it. I just was not digging the art.
Me, I got into it, and I thought the issue was actually better than the previous issue. It might be the previous two issues we've been in this story. So yeah, it has been, because we had the dinosaurs and then we had Bart. So far, I think this is the best issue we've had out of the three so far in the story arc.
And I would honestly agree with that, Drew. I do agree. And that was the thing. And I was aware of it as I was reading. I was like, you know, this isn't really that bad, but I'm not feeling it. And I couldn't really figure, I had a decent idea of why, and I kept reading. I was like, this isn't bad. Why am I not enjoying this? And I was like, oh, it's the art. As soon as it switched to the end and I saw the Reverse Flash scene, I was like, oh, I mean, I like that. What's the difference here?
The art's got you hung up.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Wonder Girl number 1. The issue opens up with the Amazons being attacked, and I'm guessing that was Ares and his armies of skeleton soldiers? We see a young Yara Flor being held by her mother. Yara runs from her mother's arms, see her stab Ares in the leg. Ares is about to kill Yara when her mother takes her place, and then Ares takes off her head. Well, at least I thought that was Ares. Did you think that was Ares?
That's my best guess.
I didn't know who else it could have been. I mean, I could be wrong. It could be somebody else. They did not tell us who that is. So I'm hoping they reveal that sometime down the line.
Yeah, I'm with you. My best guess is that is Ares.
Years later, Yara is on a plane to Brazil. We learn that Yara's aunt, Renata, raised her and never talked about Brazil. Yara saved up all her money and bought a ticket. On Themyscira, we see that Queen Nubia is watching the Amazons in playing in archery games. Queen states she feels as if a shadow has passed over her and left a stain of dread. On Mount Olympus, Hera tells Zeus of her dream of being under attack, and then we see Zeus's cup fall to the ground. In Bana Migdal, Queen Faruka realizes something's not right. On the way to the hotel, a car accident holds up the tour bus. Yara sees someone in trouble. She pulls a man from a burning car before it explodes. The bus driver is impressed and introduces himself to Yara as Jaro. I included that on here because I have a feeling we're going to be seeing this guy again, the way they introduced him. Now, at Iggy Falls, Yara is looking over the railing when she begins to hear music. A rope wraps around her neck and pulls her in to the water. At the bottom of the falls is a woman with long blonde hair and a fish tail instead of legs, which I'm guessing is a mermaid. And the issue ends there.
This was a great first issue. I mean, admittedly, not a ton happens, but again, in the same vein of the Future State comic that we got, it does a very good job building the world up. We establish essentially four different settings, and I thought pretty effectively, given if you're trying to establish four different, you know, threads and settings in one issue, you don't have a lot of time for each of them. And I thought with the time that she gave for each, she managed to do a lot. I felt like I had a good understanding of what was going on in each. I mean, you know, I've said many times how good I think Joelle Jones is as an artist. And when her writing is on par with the art, as I think it is for this character, I mean, I'm just so excited for the series. Okay, nothing. I mean, there wasn't anything that was super mind-blowing in this issue. Not a ton happens, but, you know, it's what I was hoping to see. We have clear, heavy ties to mythology, which is what I wanted. I just can't wait for more.
I thought it was really good, too. I had one question, though. Was Hera supposed to be an antagonist in this? It felt like to me that it felt like because of the presence of Yara, she wanted to attack the Amazons or something. I don't know. I was a little confused. I was wondering if maybe you could shed a little light on that for me.
No, I think that's exactly it. I think she felt like an antagonist, which is not that unusual for Greek mythology stuff. I mean, Hera, not necessarily, we haven't seen it a ton in the comics, but if we're going off of mythology, that's not out of the realm of the norm for Hera. Usually it's from like the scorned lover angle, and obviously that wouldn't quite be it, but we'll see. But she seemed clearly like an antagonist to me in this.
Yeah, she sure did. And Yara has some sort of importance. It sounded like, felt like one of the, I can't remember which factions of the Amazons, one of them felt like they had to go kill Yara because her being alive was a threat that Hera could attack them or something.
The Amazons. It was Themyscira.
Was it Themyscira?
Yeah. It was Nubia, who we know is currently, you know, the current queen of the island. She's the one that sent the kill order, which was, I thought, a particularly interesting twist because of any, you would think it would be Artemis's faction. Not to say that they aren't also going to do that, but it was specifically Themyscira that was going to go do that.
I think Joelle Jones did a great job of setting up this first issue, letting us see the different Amazon factions, Mount Olympus. You know, we got everybody's kind of point of view in this, and we get the hint of Yara's importance, and I think that story's going to unfold more, especially with, you know, Ares attacking at the beginning of the story back, you know, when she was younger. So I'm sure it all ties together, and I think it's going to be, looks like it's going to be a really interesting story. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our CW shows.
Welcome to Dr. Geek's Laboratory.
Hello, everyone. Dr. Geek here with a shout-out to all the scientists who worked tirelessly to bring a COVID-19 vaccine into reality. Let's face it, creating something of this magnitude is a miracle worthy of Dr. McCoy himself. And now, Dr. Geek needs you to do your part. Remember, each shot is one small step back to normal, one giant leap to putting the pandemic behind us. We can do this. For more information, visit vaccines.gov to find your nearest provider.
And we're back. Let's talk Batwoman Season 2, Episode 14, and Justice for All. Alice figures out that Cersei is Kate because she has her father's eyes. Batwoman tracks down a false-faced drug dealer. He's selling a modified version of Snakebite. A user runs off while Batwoman beats up the seller. When she chases after the user, Batwoman finds an old church full of users. One of the users has crazy eyes and has resorted to cannibalism. Two cops come into Ryan's bar and start causing problems, stating their music was too loud. The officers are obviously racist, and Luke tries to appease the officers, but Ryan mouths off, and both Ryan and Luke are arrested. Sophie shows up at the bar, and we see that she gets arrested too. Alice captured Enigma and confronts her about Kate. Mary has her father in the clinic because he's OD'd on snakebite. Richard Monahan stumbles in and handcuffs himself to the bed. He needs help. He's took the snake bite, and it's turning him into a cannibal. The city is becoming dangerous because the people on snake bite are all becoming cannibals and attacking everyone who comes across their path. The Gotham PD become so desperate, they put up the bat signal. Ocean kills Enigma before she can give Alice Kate's trigger word that is like a password to bring back her memories. Batwoman goes to the church and starts administering the antidote, and the crows show up and start shooting all the victims. Batwoman saves the cop that arrested Ryan earlier that night. Sophie decides that she's going to leave the crows, And Luke tries to stop Ellie, the car thief, and gets shot by the crows when he pulls out his phone to show them the photo. The one thing I'm going to say about this episode is, did we really need to have people on Snake Bite turning into zombies? Because that was basically what it was.
I mean, it's literally what, I mean, that's what they were, they, the show itself chose to describe them as such.
Usually zombies are dead. So these people are still alive. That's my argument. That's why I didn't call them zombies.
I know. I'm just saying that's what the show itself chose to describe them as zombies. I agree. They don't fit the normal definition. But the line that killed me was when they're sitting in the jail cell and the car thief joins them. And it's like, oh, you don't know? Zombies are attacking Gotham right now. As casual as can be. As if it's the most normal thing in the world. No inflection in his voice. No incredulousness that there's apparently zombies attacking the city. It's a Tuesday. It's one thing. This is a thing where, like on Legends, that would be really funny because it would be tongue-in-cheek. But on Batwoman, it's absurd because it's not meant to be tongue-in-cheek.
I agree with you. I thought I was a little crazy myself. I thought the cops coming in and harassing Ryan, it made me think of Black Lightning and how they handle stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know why they're, you know, continuing to focus on the antagonism, so to speak, of the police more. And I get it. It is interesting to me that they seem to, I know theoretically Black Mask is supposed to be the villain right now, but it feels like the show is kind of straining against that and almost wants to just make police the bad guys.
I agree with you.
Which is an interesting approach for Batwoman. Any of the CW heroes, because even Black Lightning isn't, like, yes, there are, of all the shows, Black Lightning is the one that is at odds with the police force the most, right? Even more so than Arrow. But even in both of those, both for Arrow and Black Lightning, they're not struggling against the entire, but like there are people on their side, right? They are ultimately on the side of the law, but maybe they don't see eye to eye on what that is, and for different reasons, obviously, for both shows. For Batwoman, what's interesting to me is they almost seem to want to go 100%, right? All the way, that the police force is 100% bad, and there's nothing helpful going on there, which is an interesting choice.
Yeah, I have to agree with it. It does feel like that. The show feels at odds as if it's the cops who are the villains of the season, or if it's Black Mask.
It's also, I liked the discussion in the jail cell because it had felt like the show was taking Ryan's specific, it felt like Ryan's opinion was the show's opinion, if that makes sense, where that Sophie was in a sense a traitor to her race for daring to be a cop. And I was like, I get why maybe Ryan would think that as a character, but it felt like the show was taking her side. And so it was nice to have Sophie have a different opinion and be given a chance to have that opinion. Because it was like, that's a pretty extreme take.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Black Lightning, Season 4, Episode 12, The Book of Resurrection, Chapter 1, Crossroads. Jennifer is having a hard time dealing with Uriah's death. Jefferson tells her a story of how his father was murdered by Tobias. Tobias gets a call from the shadow board because he failed to take care of Lightning. His seat has been rescinded. Tobias has one of the members of the shadow board killed by Ishmael. Tobias takes control of the shadow board. Jefferson states their main problem is that Tobias knows their secret identities. Jefferson wants to wipe Tobias's memory. Lynn is working with Gambi's girlfriend to find the device that's keeping the Pierces from having their powers. Ishmael tracks down Looker. Painkiller takes on Ishmael. Painkiller defeats Ishmael by using his poison. Anissa and Grace blow up the building that is supposed to be housing the device that's keeping them from using their powers. We see that Jennifer takes on Red. His bracelet breaks and Jen gets the upper hand. She turns him into Chief Lopez instead of killing him. Jennifer has a live feed going and Chief Lopez tells her, "I'm going to hunt you down. You and the other metafilth deserve to be wiped from the face of the earth." Chief Lopez ends up taking the meta serum and puts on the bracelet because that was broadcasted over social media. Jefferson meets up with Tobias to sign the papers for his father's house. Jefferson tries to use the device on Tobias, but Tobias stops him. Tobias crushes the device with his foot. Jennifer calls her dad to tell him that she has turned Red over to the police. Tobias answers her dad's phone and shows Jennifer that he killed Jefferson. I gotta say, that confrontation between Jefferson and Tobias at his dad's house where he, you know, shoving paper into his mouth trying to choke him like he did his father. Man, that was just brutal.
It was. But I feel like we got cheated by the way they kind of cut it short, though. I mean, I guess you have to, because if you show the full thing, that would imply an actual victory for Tobias. And we know ultimately, at least I assume, that that won't be the case for the series finale.
I know. I know you can't. I know they wanted to leave a cliffhanger with Jefferson's death. But, you know, my gut tells me he's not dead. But wouldn't that be a great twist if they did leave him dead?
Yes, but if you really killed him, I think you needed to have showed it. I don't think you can kill your main character the way they did.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I don't believe Jefferson's dead. We're going to see him come back, and we're going to get another final confrontation between him and Tobias. That's my feeling anyways.
Yeah, I agree. I honestly could, we know it's the last season. I could get behind the show actually killing the main character off because they can get away with it. Not to say that I want Black Lightning to die, but if you're going to do it, you can't do it the way they did. You can't do it off screen. You've got to show it.
Yeah, that's, I agree with you there.
A couple things I wanted to talk about with this episode. I liked, one of the things that I had not been a huge fan of was Tobias apparently working for this council. We talked about how that felt like it undercut his power. And I liked how the show addressed that, and we see him seizing power from the council. But my argument sort of remains in that I don't totally get the point of it. I don't feel like we needed this. We already see, like, I feel like it's enough to show him taking power and just controlling Freeland. I don't think we also needed that extra angle. It just feels unnecessary.
I agree with you. I don't think it needed to be in the show, that council thing at all. My gut tells me they put it in there because it's going to have something to do with the Painkiller show.
I actually wonder if it was meant to be another season. I don't think they originally planned on the show ending. It might be a relic from a future plan.
That could very well be, because I read an article talking about they were wanting to do a fifth season originally. They're going to be wrapping some stuff up in that fifth season. So
that's my guess. My guess is it's a relic, but if it's a relic, then you should have just gotten, because it's better. This version where he's taken power from them is certainly better than the initial thing that we got with it. But ultimately it just, I don't think it serves a purpose.
Okay. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about, we saw Jennifer go up to the Stratus. She goes up to the ionosphere to recharge her powers. And they've kind of been hinting at this, but did you notice in this episode the particles kind of like grabbed at her when she tried to leave? It was strange. Yes. I wonder if they're going to pay that off or not, because they've been kind of hitting it. They've been kind of hinting at it for a couple times this season, and they haven't really done anything with it yet.
I hope so. I hope they do. It would be disappointing if they didn't.
And it didn't really surprise me at all that Chief Lopez ended up taking the metahuman serum, because she's really gunning for Jennifer.
Oh, yeah. Drew, was this the first time they mentioned why she was so anti-meta? I swear I didn't remember her backstory being mentioned before. And that might be my bad memory. Or maybe it was like an early line I didn't really pay attention.
But this time we got the comment where the detective is talking to her and being like, look, I know your husband went bad after he, you know, got the metagene, and you can't let that cloud your judgment, all this. So I was like, wait, all of this is really good. This explains so much of why she just irrationally hates metas that I felt was unexplained up until now. I was like, wait, why did we wait until now? I needed to know this like 5 episodes ago.
I remember they mentioned something early on about something about her squad or something was attacked by the meta or something. But this definitely gave us more of an explanation that should have been sooner.
I think you're mixing her up with the gal from Flash. Her squadron was the one that got killed by.
Oh yeah, you're right. I did mix up the shows. Now that I'm thinking about it more, I don't think they ever explained it. Man, I got the two shows mixed up.
Well, I will say that goes to prove my point about the sort of sameness that I feel like we're getting in the shows right now, where the plots are kind of blending. But anyway, I liked the explanation a lot, and I just wish we had gotten it sooner because it worked. I was like, well, that explains why she's so irrational. I wish I would have had that instead of the explanation just being that she's inexplicably irrational.
I agree with you. All right, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Superman and Lois, Season 1, Episode 6, Broken Trust. Jordan gets attacked by Tag, demanding to know what Jordan did to him. Jordan activates his signaler, and Superman shows up and chases Tag. Superman must save a train while Tag gets away. Morgan Edge promotes Lana to a new position because the people of Smallville trust her. Jordan's superhearing powers are developing, and he's having a hard time dealing with it. Lois goes to Lana and Kyle and asks for their help in getting into the mines. Neither one wants to jeopardize their positions with Edge because they believe Edge is helping revitalize Smallville with new jobs. During the Metropolis game, Jordan's superhearing kicks in with a high-peeled screech. Smallville's quarterback gets injured because Jordan didn't protect him. Jonathan goes in as the backup QB. Marcus Bridgewater, the Luther guy, and Lois pose as inspectors to get inside of Edge's mines. They find X-Kryptonite inside the mine. Leslie Lars shows up and tries to kill them with her heat vision. Tag shows up at Sarah's house. His powers spaz out and he hurts her. Later on, Lana and Kyle return home from their date. Sarah is missing. Later on in the game, some of Metropolis players attack Jordan on the field. Jordan struggles to keep control of his heat vision, and Clark helps him out by having him release his heat vision into his hands. Lana calls and asks Clark if Sarah was at the Metropolis game. Clark tells her no, then overhears Kyle telling Lana that Tag was at the house. Superman uses his super hearing to find Tag and Sarah. The DOD shoot at Tag, and Superman steps in the way. Some of the bullets are kryptonite. Jordan and Jonathan go out with the guys to celebrate their win, and the Metropolis players show up. Jordan throws a punch, and Jonathan blocks it with his hand, breaking it. At the end of the episode, Jordan starts having issues with his power. Clark takes him to the fortress.
I continue to enjoy this one more than a lot of the other shows. My biggest problem with this continues to be the football scenes, and I know that that seems like ticky-tack, but it's such a core part of the boys' story that when some of these scenes are so dumb, it's hard to ignore. This one's particular ticky-tack, but again, if you want to feature football that heavily, just have maybe one person on set who knows football. The villain, so to speak, is on defense, right? And he's just yelling at John without his helmet right before a play starts. Drew, you can't do that. That's a 15-yard penalty. You can't have your helmet off right before a play starts. Also, just like no person would do, like if a teenager had his helmet off and was yelling at an opposing player again seconds before a play starts, that coach would have yanked that kid out and he would have been sitting on the bench for the rest of the game because clearly his brain isn't working well. Secondly, the play where they all just decide, well, we're getting our butts kicked, so let's just all inexplicably pile onto John and allow the other team to score a touchdown. Again, either Metropolis's coach is just mind-numbingly stupid, actually a mustache-twirling villain to allow his players to do this, And again, the refs also mustache-rolling villains to be like, yeah, this is fine. There's no reason. That would result in actual suspensions. I know that that seems nitpicky stuff, but they feature football too much to have stuff that is egregious. The pile-up thing to cause John's, you know, eye thing to go off is that players would be actually suspended from school for that.
I totally agree with you. There's a third nitpick I have to add to that. When the quarterback gets injured for Smallville, the coach doesn't put in the backup quarterback. That didn't make any sense to me. Why wouldn't you stick Jonathan in right away? That's what would happen in normal football. But instead, they don't do that. He has to actually argue with the coach to put him in. I thought it was stupid.
Drew, I completely agree with you. However, that one I actually accepted, not because it made sense, but because I felt like the show had already established that Smallville's coach is a moron. So that one made sense to me. I was like, oh, that makes sense that he wouldn't have put in the other brother because he's an idiot. So of course he wouldn't have done that yet. But I agree with you, Drew. It's stupid. Your quarterback gets hurt. You put in the backup quarterback who was supposed to start at a different school before he transferred there. So it's not like this coach has treated him like he's just like never played football in his life. Like, I don't think you can handle it, son. But he can, because he was going to do it for another team before he transferred here. So he does actually understand how football works. Anyway, I agree with you. I totally agree. But that one actually I didn't think about, only because I already accepted that this show had established that coach is an idiot. Whether that's intentional or not, I'm not sure. Probably not. But I had already accepted that.
I was bummed when Jordan lost control and broke Jonathan's hand. I didn't like that.
One thing I think the show is doing well, and I think part of this is due to the actor, I think is frankly the better of the two, but Jonathan is quite likable, so far for me at least. He always seems to be doing the right thing. He frequently is making the right decision. For the most part, I know we've had one episode where he got drunk and made maybe not the best decision, but also pretty understandable considering that the show constantly chooses to screw him over. I swear the show is determined to make him a villain. On the other hand, Jordan is, I don't think the show's doing a very good job making him a likable character. And I think they want you to like him more. I don't know what you think, Drew. I feel like the show wants me to like Jordan more than Jonathan. And maybe they don't care. Maybe they don't. Maybe they just want you to like both of them equally, or they don't care which one you like more. But it's not even close to equal. And it's tough because, it seems like the show would prefer Jordan to be the one in the spotlight. But they have him be, like, you know, making the wrong choice or being maybe not intentionally a jerk, but unintentionally a jerk, or just once again ruining the day for the other brother. And it's just like, but I'm supposed to like him, right?
I agree with you. I think the show is trying to make Jordan more likable than Jonathan too. And I don't know, because Jordan, we see Jordan making, like, throwing a punch at one of the Smallville guys. We see Jonathan has to step in and stop it. He seems to be the more sensible brother. Jordan seems to be more out of control. This is how they've been portraying him. So one of these times, Jonathan's got to have something going right for him.
Yeah, it's one of the things where I feel like the show wants to make Jonathan a villain. Just because everything goes wrong for him. Like, everything that could go wrong for him thus far into the season has gone wrong. And everything just keeps turning up aces for Jordan, despite arguably not really deserving all of it. It's just like, wow, I just don't understand the thought process here. I'm sure we'll see. I'm sure they have a plan to pay that off at some point, but it's just odd the way that, you know, the way the actors are playing the characters. Jordan's not particularly likable to me, but I feel like I'm supposed to like him.
And I can't see Jonathan turning into a villain the way he acts. He's got his dad's do-gooder attitude.
I agree. But it just feels like inevitable that he's going to get like pushed too far. Right? We're going to finally have the thing that makes him snap. Like, you know what? Enough. I've had enough. I deserve this.
So we'll just have to see how it goes on the show.
All I have to say, so for the most part, I am enjoying this show. If they've got a dude that's supposed to be in charge of the football scenes, they need to fire him and hire somebody that's maybe watched a couple games in his life.
All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week, The Flash, Season 7, Episode 10, Family Matters, Part 1. Instead of killing Dion, the Steel Force, Nora, the Speed Force, teams up with Dion against their common enemy, Barry Allen, who rejected both of them. Psych has attacked 4 billionaires in one day. Kramer is sticking around Central City longer to find out the source of this city's metahuman problem. There are a whole lot of cases where metahumans just disappear, and we see she brings up Patty Spivot, Julian Albert, and Barry Allen, and Kramer wants to talk to Barry. Psych tries to attack another billionaire, but the Flash shows up. Psych throws Flash into a limousine, realizes he's dead, and then takes off. Joe finds out that Kramer has weapons that can shoot bullets with the Medicure. Kramer plans on using them against criminal metas. Psych attacks.
That can't be legal.
Oh, go ahead.
That storyline, Bob, you can't do that court case thing where they establish that legally that's hazy to be able to do that. Again, as an actual punishment, to then just be able to just shoot them willy-nilly? Come on. What? What? That can't be something that just gets decided.
I totally agree with you. Psych attacks another billionaire. Flash and Alexa zoom out to confront him. Furza and Psych fight. Barry tries to convince Psych to join them and be family. Alexa convinces him to join the family. Joe calls Kramer into his office and quits his job as police chief. Nora and Dion show up at the end of the episode, and it looks like they kill the other forces and Iris. Which I doubt. Of course, they can just be resurrected.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know why it would matter one way or the other. They can just snap them back to life.
And we know Iris.
Anything anymore.
We know Iris isn't dead, so. So even if the other forces got killed, Barry and Iris could just hold hands and bring him back to life.
Exactly. Well, you can't kill your main character of your show. So, like you said, Iris is assuredly alive.
I see where this is going. In part two, we're going to be one old big happy family. They're all going to team up. They're all going to either be one big happy family or they're going to team up against Nora. Or the Speed Force, or whatever.
We're gonna get the patented Flash win, Drew. They're going to initially fight, and then Barry and or Iris and or both will give a passionate speech, and the villain will be like, "Okay," and then they'll all get along.
Exactly, because that's real life.
But that's how the Flash has done it. That's how they've decided. Barry doesn't need fists when he's got a big heart.
Oh, man, you had to bring that up, didn't you?
That was a thesis statement from the show. That was the show telling you that's how the Flash is going to resolve conflict, guys. It's so dumb. I don't want to talk about how mind-numbingly stupid this idea of them being the children of Iris and Barry, but whatever. Moving past that, the whole first half of this season was focused on inexplicably positioning the Speed Force as Barry's mom. And then now, right at the very end, now all of a sudden she's a daughter? What? I mean, at least be consistent with your stupid family portrayal.
Oh, man. Can this story be over? Hopefully it's over in part two.
I do think it will be. The thing that I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, my concern is you either have to address, like, acknowledge in the future that this story happened, or best case scenario, hopefully, they just pretend like it never happened. And we just never again address the fact that there are different forces out there somewhere that are
weirdly somehow considered to be Barry's kids, even though they're absolutely not Barry's kids. Ah, God, it's one of the things. It's bad, but I also don't know how the show isn't tainted in a sense by this in the future. There are certain storyline bad storylines that you can just move on from. Like, we're not huge fans of the evil time remnant version of Barry, but for the most part, we kind of pretend like it didn't happen on the show. I don't know how you pretend this one didn't happen. Barry still has the Speed Force. You can't ever fully ignore this one.
Yeah, I don't know. Can we get a new showrunner, please?
And I don't think the showrunner is good at his job, number one. But this is consistent with his philosophy in that he wants to feature, you know, current modern Flash stories. But I could have told you that this story would be garbage, even if the showrunner was good. It wasn't going to be very good because the comic it's based on was garbage. This story wasn't any better in the comics. And I don't know why they thought it was going to suddenly be really good on the show. It was a terrible story, and it got adapted into a shockingly even worse story on TV. What did they expect?
I don't know. All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. DC's Legends of Tomorrow, Season 6, Episode 3, The X-Factor. The episode opens up in Palm Springs 2045. An alien in body armor shows up at a futuristic convenience store demanding to see the leader, DJ Shmore Money, Zara's ex-boyfriend. The alien in the body armor shows up as a wild card on the singing competition to challenge the king. Nate and Brad stop Lord Noxcrillion from killing DJ Shmore Money. The legends explain to Lord Noxcrillion to win the throne, he is going to sing and dance. Lord Noxcrillion accepts the challenge. Zarya announces to her fan that she's going to be the wild card on the throne. Plus, John sets DJ S'more's head on fire. Gary eats the aliens that are after Sarah, only to discover they are Ava clones. Zarya beats Lord Noxcrillion in the competition, and he pledges his fealty. Lord Noxcrillion reveals he's a tiny alien, and Mick steps on him. Sarah realizes she's being deceived by the Ava clone. She knocks it out and then comes face to face with the man who has been waiting a long time for Sarah.
I'm very sure, actually, that the guy that Sarah meets at the end is the person that wrote the book from the first episode. I can't remember what his name was, but he was in hell. And he supposedly wrote this magic that pertained to aliens, and John thought he was a kook. I feel very confident that's who that is.
Okay, because I wasn't sure who it was at all.
I have to say, I was a little bummed, actually. I'm not shocked that they did it. I was a little bummed that they killed the alien at the end. Just because I get not wanting to do the special effects for the actual alien all the time, but surely the special, like, just having that dude wearing that relatively cheap robot suit couldn't have been that bad. I don't know. I kind of would have liked that to have been around for maybe another episode or so.
I've been enjoying this season so far. It's been crazy with all these aliens.
Yeah, I agree. And I wasn't expecting the Noxcrillion to become like a permanent crew member or anything, but I was a little bummed. I thought maybe we'd get maybe one episode where we see, because he was just so funny. I loved the sort of fish out of water that they were able to do with his character. Again, I'm not shocked that Mick stepped on him, but I have to admit, I was a little bit disappointed. I was like, oh, I think you could have done more with him.
Yeah, they probably could have, but I'm sure they'll move on to something new next episode. That's the thing that's different with this show than the other shows. They can do crazy stuff and it doesn't freaking matter.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And
the show makes fun of itself.
That's the best part. The show, by not taking itself
seriously, you can get away with some other stuff. And you give it the benefit of the doubt. When something absurd happens, you assume that it's intentionally absurd and not unintentionally absurd like some of these other shows.
Agreed. Me, I look forward to watching Legends every week. Because I know I'm going to get
it. It's the one I save for the end.
That. What do you think I have it? What do you think I have it last every episode?
If I watched it first, I would have such lower motivation to finish some of the other ones. So I always make sure to save it last so that I'm like, well, I've still got it. I still got something that I know for sure that I'll enjoy at least a little bit.
There's a method to my madness. There's a reason Batwoman's first and Legends is last. All right. Well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout out, Cletus?
Yeah. So my girlfriend and I have been watching, the Harley Quinn animated series. It's on. As we talked about quite a long time ago, it did first appear on the DC app, and it has since migrated over to HBO Max, and it's just so funny. We're hoping to move on to season two here shortly. We're catching up on some other shows, but it's if you haven't checked it out, it's hilarious. There's some really good DC specific jokes. Kite Man, I love that he's in it. Bane, they're clearly just constantly poking fun at the Dark Knight Rises version of Bane because his thing is threatening to blow stuff up like he blew up the football stadium. It's so good. It's so funny.
I'm going to have to check that out. Now, I haven't got a chance to read it yet, but your shout out from last week, I've downloaded and I've got it to read. I just haven't had a chance to read it yet. So I'm looking forward to reading it this weekend. Finding out.
Yeah, I saw that you had downloaded that. And I was like, oh, I recognize that number.
When I put it in our show notes last week, I looked at it. And I was like, hey, there were some other interesting stories in it. That wasn't the only story in it. There was a couple. Looks like there's a couple stories in it. And I wanted to check it out. So I'll try to get that read this week. And give you guys an update on what I think of it next week for my shout out.
I was so intrigued when I saw. I have to admit, I didn't realize Clue Master was as old of a character as he was. Just because when I think of him now, I just think of Spoiler's dad, and she's such a modern character. I just obviously associate him with more modern DC stuff as well. So I was surprised when I saw that.
Yeah, I think Stephanie Brown was introduced during the Tim Drake's Robin run.
I'm almost positive you're right.
Back when I was, I think the Robin run, I think I was in college, first or second year of college when they introduced Spoiler. I'm pretty sure Robin's third miniseries came out during my first year of college. So the Robin run would have, because she showed up in like issue 4 or 5. They introduced her pretty early on in the series. So, yeah, if they came up with Clue Master way back then, she's definitely a more modern character. Of course, she's been around for quite a while now, but shoot, we even saw her in Batwoman, which is kind of hard to believe. But all right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got the next Batman, Batman Black and White, the other history of the DC Universe, Stargirl Spring Break, Batman Superman, Strange Adventures, Action Comics, Detective Comics, Robin, Teen Titans Academy, our CW shows, Superman and Lois, The Flash, DC Legends of Tomorrow, and the series finale of Black Lightning. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.